com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Next Tuesday night, we will know the identity of Charlotte's next mayor, and that person could be our guest this hour. Edwin Peacock is the Republican candidate in the race against Democrat Jennifer Roberts. The former city councilman has run, I believe, twice before, maybe once. I meant to ask you this before we actually started this.
I've run once before for mayor.
Okay, the last time he was narrowly defeated by Patrick Cannon. This time, Mr. Peacock is hoping for, obviously, a different outcome. To be clear, we invited his opponent to join us this hour, but Jennifer Roberts declined our invitation more than once. We most recently heard her make her case in a debate we aired live on this program prior to the Democratic runoff, which she won against Mayor Dan Clodfelter. Roberts and Edwin Peacock will appear in one last debate already recorded to be aired on WTVI this weekend, but this hour, Edwin Peacock is here by himself to talk about his candidacy, the issues, and his vision for Charlotte. Welcome.
Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. This is your second attempt at mayor. Last time you lost by a really slim margin, and I say slim because it's a Democratic city, mm-hmm. and you're a Republican candidate, so losing by that few number of votes was really impressive. What made you come back? Why do you want this job?
In May of this year, my wife and I had known that the number one question that we'd been receiving since the beginning of the year, especially following what happened to our last mayor, was, are you going to run again? And my answer was, I'll consider it. And I did consider it. And we reached a point in which I realized that some of my gifts and some of my skills and some of my desire to be in leadership hadn't gone away. And then I came to the reality that I would regret this if I did not attempt this again, because I felt as though there had been a lot of momentum that had been built from our first campaign, and it's very unfortunate what happened to our last mayor. And so that brought me to the decision to run. On May 19th, we launched our campaign with a whiteboard video coming out from a completely different perspective, trying to bring people back to where we were in 2013 and what we felt like just in 2014. My Democratic opponents certainly didn't want people to think about what had happened, but we wanted to draw a contrast, to talk about what the future could be about, and most importantly, to engage Charlotte voters. With 82% of Charlotte not participating in the election, you look at it and you say, well, what is wrong? What is wrong in either state or local or federal government? And what we're seeing is just, again, apathy. Apathy being the enemy, really, of good government. And that's really largely what Charlotte has enjoyed for so many decades.
I mean, you're relatively young, although you have a family, so you have a lot of time constraints on you. I think you run a small business.
Yep.
What is it in your DNA that makes you so passionate about this that you would, because it would be very easy for you to come home from work every night and just be with the family. You won't be able to do that as mayor.
Yep.
What is it in your DNA that makes you want to do this and are willing to do this?
Well, two things. One, I grew up with some examples of public servant leadership, first through my father. So in 1974, when I was 4 years old, I went on the campaign trail with my father, who was influenced by then County Commissioner Jim, well, at this time, he wasn't county commissioner, he was running for Congress, but it was Jim Martin, Governor Martin. So I've had examples of leadership as this is what we do. You participate as a business owner or a professional, and we give to our community, and then we step back into private life. And so I saw that through my father. I saw that through my Sunday school teacher, Richard Venerut. And I saw it, again, just time and time again around the men and the women that my father associated with, great friendship he had with Liz Hare, again, Tom Cox, Carla Dupuy, Cindy Patterson. There just were so many men and women, Eddie Knox, John Belk. Many of these men and women were just people that I had come in contact with. And so, Mike, when I moved back from Washington, D.C., where I lived for almost 12 years, I knew if there was an opportunity to run for office, you know, I would do that. And it actually came through a program called Leadership Charlotte. And when we graduated, the call to action was, how are you going to give back? And I felt like that if I matched all my skills up, I said, this is the way that I can give back. And it just so happened that then Councilman Pat Mumford was not running, and I got the opportunity to run. Right. And I won. Very narrow race in my first city council race in 2007. Pat McCrory was running for mayor. He had no challenger, really, of any significance, and he was largely expected to win.
For newcomers, I just said this is a Democratic city, and it is. The majority of voters are registered Democrats, but we have a tradition in Charlotte of electing Republican mayors.
Yeah, we do.
We had 14 years of Pat McCrory. He's a Republican. We had several years of Sue Myrick. You mentioned Richard Vinroot. He was also a mayor, and he's also a Republican. I would take it, then, that you have to rely on independents to win this contest. And if you believe the chart that appeared in the paper a couple of days ago, there, if you add up all the independents and all the Republicans, you come up just about even with the Democrats. Mm-hmm. So you're going to need to sway some Democrats, right?
Absolutely. And that's and again, when
is
you
is this possible to do to take all of the independents and some of the Democrats?
It is. And remember, when I won in 2007 and when I won in 2009 as an at-large city council member, that means everybody votes on you. In 2007, we had a mayor's race that was low turnout because Pat didn't really have a challenger of any significance. 2009 was John Lasseter and Anthony Fox. That was our highest turnout in almost 25 years. Edwin Peacock won in both of those races. It proves that it's person over party. And what you have to understand, what listeners have to understand, is you have to destroy the myth, in my opinion, that a Republican can't win. And I think the reason why is because if I was elected in both of those terms, where Charlotte was still 50% Democratic and it's still 50% Democratic, what's really changed, Mike, and you just hit right on it, is that we've seen a drop in the Republican registrations here in Charlotte, either a defection from people from our party or from the Democratic Party moving to the independents or the unaffiliateds. So 29% of Charlotte is now unaffiliated. It's certainly the middle that is right there for obviously both parties to really take advantage of. But in my case, we have to make a great appeal to those. And more importantly, to I would consider in my party, we've got a lot of low propensity Republicans who just simply are sitting out local elections. In fact, our target universe, if you will, has been towards voters that have skipped the last three municipal elections.
But hasn't that been the Republican strategy for years now to regain control of the Congress, to start at the local level and infiltrate is a negative word, but to start at the local level, win elections, become established, and then move into the legislature, move into the Congress?
I wouldn't say I've ever seen any written strategy that would be it. But in the city of Charlotte, we've had, obviously, again, a balance of both Republicans and Democrats. Pat, you know, when McCrory was here, he served, I believe, five of his seven terms were served with Democratic majority. So it's very unlikely that we're going to see a situation in the near future where Charlotte would have a majority city council that would be Republican.
Tell me why you are a Republican.
I'm a Republican because I believe in the free enterprise system. Secondly, I believe in the rights of the individual as opposed to the government to make decisions for you. That's probably the fundamental difference between a Republican and a Democrat, is really just the view of government, the role of government in individuals' lives. I also believe very much in, again, the ability for people to choose to be able to put their own path to which direction they want to go, earning their success, making their way, not having people in the government help you with your job or with other types of services. There is a role for government, and I've certainly seen that on the local level, and I want to see that continue. But again, we see ourselves, I think, the most effective when we're a smaller and a more effective government.
Is this a good time to be a Republican in North Carolina and in Charlotte, given what we've seen at the legislature? And a lot of people are upset with a lot of the things that the legislature have done. A lot of people are disappointed in what Pat McCrory has done as governor, particularly people from Charlotte who saw him as a potential to bring great hope to the great state of Mecklenburg by his presence in Raleigh, to what we see going on in the Congress, even within the Republican Party in the House of Representatives, where Paul Ryan is struggling to earn complete control as Speaker of the House against the Tea Party faction, which he's already kind of caved into a little bit just to get the election. Yeah. Is it a good time to be a Republican?
I think it is, and I know it is, and the reason why is because you can look at our presidential field and you can see a whole variety of candidates who are bringing all different types of their feelings of which direction the Republican Party is going to be coming towards.
Except some people have described it as a clown car.
Well, that's correct. And again, that's why I'm saying some people. How I look at the presidential field and how it trickles down to North Carolina is I'm looking at candidates who are looking and appealing to what I consider to be the best in people, not the worst in us. And that's the type of candidate that I am as candidate for mayor. I want to see a positive, forward-thinking city that we've always been, balanced, looking ahead, seeing where our next new opportunity is going to be. And that's really where you want to be able to develop your own brand. And in my case, my brand here in Charlotte, North Carolina has been just that, has been to be balanced, forward-thinking, a critical thinker, someone that is both independent in their mindset. But again, in my case, I come from a conservative philosophy. Again, that view of government, that government works best when it plays not the primary role in people's lives, but a minor role. And so when you look on the national side, again, I think folks, especially here locally, Mike, frequently the question I ask is, where do we differ on local issues? Do you want good schools? Do you want good roads? Do you want safe streets? Those are things where I rarely find individuals, as I speak to them locally, where we differ on those things. And it's the same approach that I'd be taking as I'm looking at this position, because I'm going to be working with a Democratic majority. We have shared priorities of making safe streets, obviously bringing economic development, diversifying our economy. I look at all seven of our district representatives and all four of the at-large members, and I say, how can we work together to accomplish these objectives? And that is what we need in a mayor. That's the effectiveness of what a mayor can do. It's not a position of power. It is a position of influence. And the influence that you have to have is for positive change, and that's why I've simply said that, hey, I want to make a positive impact and I want to improve lives in Charlotte, and I want to use the city council where the power resides, not in the mayor's position, but with the city council.
This has suddenly and very quickly become one of the biggest cities in the country.
Mm-hmm.
We're, but geographically speaking, population speaking, bigger than Atlanta. I mean, the city of Charlotte is bigger than the city of Atlanta, not the whole area of influence down there, but we're a big city now. Is it time for a more powerful mayor? Is it time for, because the mayor is a part-time job. It's a guy who, or a woman who votes to break ties and has moral leadership,
mm-hmm.
pushes and nudges and pushes buttons. But you can't say, by God, this is what we're gonna do and we're gonna, because I'm the mayor.
Yeah.
So is it time for that to happen?
I don't believe so. And the reason why is because I've yet to see a full-time mayor, a full-time government that has been effective in governing. And what we see in our cities that have a full-time mayor is you see corruption, you see graft, you see nepotism, you see ineffectiveness. The reason the city manager form of government works for the state of North Carolina and for other large major metropolitan areas, Dallas, Texas being the other one, is that you wouldn't want a mayor who comes and brings their private sector business skills to be in charge of hiring the solid waste director. Why? Because I'm just going to hire somebody that's either a large donor or somebody that's maybe a friend of a friend. And all of a sudden, the allegiances get built, and all of a sudden, we wake up and we look and we feel a lot like some of these other major cities where that occurs. Chicago being kind of the classic, followed by cities like New Orleans. You've got cities like Los Angeles. Again, patterns of that. Again, that's why I believe that why our form of government works so well and why a two-year term works so well to boot is that we have to have leaders to come from the private sector and bring their skill sets to contribute to the leadership and the direction of the city. That's the intention, really, of the way that we've structured our city council, is to do just that, to have all seven districts represent those that live in those seven districts, four at-large representatives, and then a mayor that reflects that. The mayor is going to be the one that convenes and pulls those together to work towards the shared priorities, what we call the city of Charlotte, the five focus areas of what the core functions are of the city, and hopefully you want to keep the ship on the right direction, and that's the way I want to. That's the way I want to lead.
Pat, we asked a question on social media before we even began. Edwin Peacock, Republican candidate for mayor, is our guest. What questions do you have for him? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter at WFAE. And Patty on Twitter writes, "How do you distinguish yourself from the rest of the state GOP?" And you have 45 seconds to answer that.
Well, Patty, I think that you can look at a leader and look to what they're going to do in the future by looking at what they've done in the past. I don't need to use my words to describe the type of leader that I've been. I'll use the Charlotte Observer's endorsement this weekend of my campaign, who described me as a bridge builder and a consensus builder. That's been described to me since I began, and that's the way that they're evaluating myself versus my opponent. And again, as I've just articulated before, that's the type of leader that I'm going to be as mayor.
Edwin Peacock is our guest. He's the Republican candidate for mayor in the election, which takes place definitively next Tuesday, although early voting is underway. We're coming right back. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Aldersgate, undergoing a transformative expansion of its 234-acre campus that will include 62 new apartments and villas. Details at aldersgateccrc.com. Although early voting is certainly underway, official election day is Tuesday, as we all know, and Charlotte voters will be electing a new mayor. We're talking to a candidate right now, members of city council and at-large school board members. So tomorrow we have assembled a panel of reporters to drill down and fill you in on what they know about those running for office, and we get an update on the incident at that Columbia High School that has attracted the attention of the FBI. That's all tomorrow morning at 9.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, Republican presidential candidates debate for the third time. The House moves to elect Paul Ryan as its new speaker and a possible budget deal. The latest on the GOP.
Join the Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest today is Edwin Peacock, the Republican candidate for mayor of Charlotte. Jennifer Roberts, his Democratic challenger, declined our invitation, multiple requests actually, to join us on today's program, citing a lack of availability. If you recall, however, she did appear with Dan Klotfelter in a live debate on this program several weeks ago. From the McGlohan Theater right down the hall, and she took that contest, which is why she is running against Edwin Peacock. Now, there's a final debate in the mayor's race, which has already been recorded. Mm-hmm. It's going to be on WTVI on Sunday. Do you know what time? I couldn't find that anywhere.
I do not know.
Because they're running a series of debates. I think the county commission, school board, mm-hmm. people like that will be in a series of debates on WTVI, which is the public television station here. In that debate, I am told, you slammed Jennifer Roberts' record as a Mecklenburg County commissioner and as the chair of that commission, criticizing her for a number of things, including the county's botched 2011 property revaluation and for a property tax increase that came as a result. How exactly was that revaluation her fault?
Let's look back to first where Jennifer Roberts made a decision in 2005 and 2006 to raise taxes by 10.6%. Then as we approached the go-go times that were then warned in 2008 of a recession coming, the county was warned of its problem with their spending, and particularly increasing credit limits. As the recession began, they continued to spend, and the rating agency says you had to go on a debt diet. So poor budgeting and poor spending moved Jennifer Roberts and that county commission to have to cut almost $150 million from education. We remember libraries closing here in Charlotte,
but
other critical services.
But that was the recession.
That's correct. However, again, what led up to it was poor budgeting skills that allowed us to have to close schools here. Now, it leads up to the pattern of leadership failure for Jennifer, and that was to address tough problems and to challenge county staff to what citizens, as the revaluation came, mm-hmm. She and others on the county commission were approached about problems with revaluation occurring. During that recession, people's taxes were going up, and people began complaining. And she simply was not willing to address those problems. She was defending staff consistently. And then it ultimately took state action to undo that. And again, don't take my words for it. Take the Charlotte Observer's words for it, defined by repeated timidity to confront challenges and to hold people accountable. And they're referring to the county. They're referring to the county staff.
And not firing Harry Jones, the county manager?
Well, yes. I mean, again, he's obviously was the county manager at the time. And so, Mike, what I'm pointing to here is just a pattern of unwillingness to confront a tough problem. But more importantly, again, in this case, what I think is most revealing about Jennifer's leadership style was what she said when the county commission decided to take the chairmanship away from her. She said she kept her personal integrity in the process, but she kept her promise to the Democratic Party. And the Charlotte Observer called her out on that and asked what that comment meant. And what it meant was that she was giving party allegiance over the taxpayers and the people that had, in this case, almost $70 million returned to them. So I questioned her in that debate. I question her now.
But isn't that precisely what the Republican legislature and the Republican Congress is doing? Are they not being loyal to party over country, over state in many cases?
Well, I think these are two separate issues that you're mentioning. I think we're talking about, again, Mecklenburg County taxpayers knowing from Mint Hill to Matthews to Myers Park that they paid too much. The state had to take action to say, yes, you will go back and reevaluate this. Jennifer was defending county staff, and again, the end result was We had a chairmanship change to Harold Cogdale, then followed by Pat Cotham. There were tough decisions made. There was a change in the House and the leadership of the county staff. And again, the revaluation moved forward and $70 million has been brought back to the taxpayers. I haven't even mentioned the other crises that were occurring amidst all of this. Department of Social Services crisis. We had the Giving Tree crisis. We had a county manager that sent out an email to a private citizen that was quite alarming because he was sort of calling out a citizen as to that. I mean, these were the pattern of largely management malfeasance that needed to be addressed. Remember, county staff serves at the pleasure of their board, and it's the exact same on the Charlotte City Council. Our current city manager and previous city managers are there at the pleasure of the board. That's the way the statute's set up. Again, I point to how a leader is going to act in the future by what they've done in the past. That's the first thing for Jennifer that, again, that's what the Observer has appropriately put together in their endorsement of me and obviously their critique of her and her leadership.
You already mentioned their endorsement that they said that they called you a bridge builder, and I think you've called yourself a bridge builder.
Yes.
So give me some instances in which you have built bridges.
I'll talk first on the city council, a rather minor scenario. Again, this is sort of inside baseball, but there was a lot of tension in the first few months following Anthony Fox coming in as mayor. If you'll remember, the first decision that was quite controversial was there was an incident between one of our district representatives who was being accused of sexual harassment. It was then followed by Marcus Jackson trial, where we had an officer that was accused of and ultimately convicted for offending and getting into bad situations with citizens. And Anthony wanted that the human resources file opened up. I saw a real sense of tension building within this city council in the first few months. Anthony was a brand new mayor. I just asked all of our council members to do something that we normally don't do, and I think people think that we do more of this, which was to come over to my office, and we just had a cocktail, just some wine, and got together. And it's the only time that I remember in my 4 years where we really did that during the week. That's just one example. Other bridge-building examples have just been my leadership on the environment as the chair of the Environmental Committee. Again, I'm a Republican chairing a committee with many that are Democratic in their leanings. Again, I wanted to try to strike a balance between what we needed to accomplish in this city with the newest focus area. I'd like to think that my 4 years as the environmental chair and dealing with one ordinance, which was known as the tree ordinance, it took us almost 4 years to get that right. I look at that as basically a piece of legislation that ultimately boils down to bringing together the Birkenstocks and the wingtips. This was the development community, Mike, meeting up with our friends in the environmental community to try to come up with a sound balance and try to preserve, obviously, our trees that we so love in this city, but also be respectful to the development and the pace and the growth of the second fastest growing city in the country. And so, again, it was not a pretty process. It was what we refer to in local government and also federal government as sausage making. A lot of people weren't pleased with it, but we got it right, I think. And then the state undid some things.
Exactly, which we'll talk about. I have so many questions. Let me try to bullet through some of these
things.
You have outlined some of the things you'd like to do as mayor, and at the top of the list is focusing on reducing crime. You say that Charlotte has a crime problem. Why do you say that?
After Labor Day, we found out that we have more murders than we had in all of 2014. Mm-hmm. We know over Labor Day we had 12 shootings. 5 people were killed, and one of them was a 7-year-old. We still do not have any significantly publicly known clues to that crime issue. I believe it's a gang problem. I believe that's a word that we are trying to scrub from our process because it doesn't really bode real well for the chamber or for Charlotte to be saying that we have a gang problem.
But we do have a gang task force on the police department, which we've had for years.
Yes.
Because they've acknowledged that
they have a gang problem. They have. But what's happened is that we had a program that's called Gang of One, which was a federally funded program that received a grant from DOJ. We had gotten warning that they were going to stop funding that. Police felt as though we didn't need that. I think we need to consider funding that again. It's moved under the heading at CMPD as youth engagement, which is certainly important. But when we talk about being tough on crime, I think the other side of it, Mike, is certainly prevention. And when we look at trying to prevent children – of these ages, 12, 15, 16 years old, from joining a gang anywhere in our city, we've got to look at ways in which we can obviously provide them alternatives, but more importantly, give them a bigger and brighter vision for that. So I've asked for a citizens task force. Now, gosh, how many times have you heard that, Mike? I mean, everybody wants to form a citizens task force. But I look back and I ask the city council to provide me, again, when's the last time we did a comprehensive plan that was citizens-based, working arm-in-arm with our police chief, work with our faith leaders to come up with a comprehensive plan? Because crime in seven areas of Charlotte is not going to benefit anyone if you don't feel safe. So I've just said that we need to do that. That's a way that I can rally my city council members around something that I consider to be a common cause, which is everyone is obviously for reducing crime, and we got to do that together.
Is that what you mean when you say the mayor must be proactive and not reactive?
Yeah, absolutely. Crime? And you remember in 2009 we had a spike in crime that was led by the formation of a group called Neighbors for Safer Charlotte. There was a march on city council, outbreak in crime. This was just before we hired Chief Monroe. I felt the real sense of what I mean when I say proact, not react. We were reacting to crime at that point, and it became this general sense and feeling in some areas where people normally weren't used to crime happening. They were all of a sudden becoming victims of crime. And again, you hear it loud and clear as an elected official when that occurs, because nothing else that I would say after that would matter on my platform if you don't feel safe where you live. So that's why I think it's important. The second thing to my crime plan, again, and I know this sounds it's again one of the things that a mayor has to know that they can't do. You can't ever get ahead of your city council. They are the power. My job as mayor would be to lead and to be an effective influencer about a public policy that we all agree on, which is where we spend 80% of our tax dollars, which is on police and fire. So again, rally around that first big, large budget item for the city. I think the other thing following the Carrick-Farrell trial that I think is extremely instructive and something that I did while I was in Leadership Charlotte was to do a police ride-along. Why do council members need to do that, either on a frequent basis or certainly in my case, I'd like to do that with them as their mayor, is that I want to see what's happening in all four corners of our city. More importantly, I want them to understand what's happening in their neighborhoods. And if they feel they already know their neighborhood, why don't they go to another neighborhood? Again, it's building. This is a government of the people and for the people, and it works very much the same way, clearly, at the local level. So I feel like those are two critical ingredients where, as a mayor, I'm not getting ahead of my council members, but what I want to do is I want them engaged and grafted into the process of coming up with a comprehensive plan. Let's look at some examples, Mike. 1992, huge crime outbreak in Boston. They put together a 10-point plan there. Point one sort of jumped right out at me because Kerr Putney has put together, along with the former chief Monroe, they've come up with cops and barbers. Not even really intentionally have they tripped over this program, which is really meant to be an intervention and an education program around some of our most challenged youth and about their relationship with law enforcement. But when we look at the Boston plan, what they did there was they married the faith community, and they had faith-based organizations adopting gangs, actually moving forward with a real relationship there. And then my conversations with the chief was that we've had in-and-out relationships with some parts of our faith community. We need more of that. I can't do that, but my district representatives and my at-large council members can work arm-in-arm with them. That is a win-win. And again, it doesn't happen overnight. I want to see us get that right, and I think everybody will feel a lot better when you do that.
Edwin Peacock is our guest. He's running for mayor in Charlotte as a Republican. His Democratic challenger, Jennifer Roberts, declined our invitation to be on this program today. You want to lower the tax burden on families and businesses. Before we talk about how, tell us what the revenue sources for the city of Charlotte are.
Primary revenue source is property taxes. It's a very consistent revenue source, a little different than the way that the county is structured. And I point to just that property tax, again, where we've experienced, in this case, two consecutive property tax increases. My opponent seems to think that she would somehow evaluate this more, but she won't answer what she would be for or against on that. We believe in her consideration of being for the trolley streetcar that she was in favor, and she would be in favor of the last two consecutive tax increases. So spending, budgeting, what can we do here in Charlotte? I say we need to be more efficient with our spending rather than relying on these property tax and fee increases that we find ourselves in now, because it is such a thin budget around the general fund. A few areas that I think are definitely something that could be a collaborative opportunity for us. We know within the city of Charlotte that we have a county and we have a city human resources department at 600 East 4th Street. Those two could be consolidated and yield some savings. Secondly, we know that EMS and fire are two divisions that many citizens don't realize. One is county, one is city. Again, they're important organizations that obviously have their own funding sources, but is there opportunity for savings? And I think the third one, which has been well identified and talked about, oh gosh, for my entire 8 years of being running for office or being in office, has been the county and the city permitting process when you've got to start a business or file a rezoning. Those are some opportunities there. They don't happen overnight, but as a mayor, you've got to pick one and find one where we've got some shared priorities.
But now you're a Republican. If you win, you'll be a Republican leading a Democratic city council. We know that there are differences of opinion between Republicans and Democrats about what's important and whether you raise money for a streetcar or you put it someplace else or you're more careful in your budgeting. How do you come together with people who may have a completely different point of view on these issues than you?
We have to have a plan B when you speak about transportation, and I'm in favor of our mass transit program. I've been in favor of the light rail. I've been in favor of our bus system.
But not in favor of the streetcar.
But not in favor of the streetcar, and the reason why is because in order to complete Phase 2 and Phase 3, it needs state and federal funding. So where do my friends in the Democratic Party, where do we agree? We agree that that money might not show up, Mike. So the question is, are they in favor? Is my opponent in favor of a third consecutive tax increase? You cannot look any further than our budget process to understand that the money is not going to come from the revenue source that is funding our transit plan, which is the half-cent sales tax. That is being paid for by all of our six towns and counties. And, Mike, we're reaching the end of the bandwidth in which we can use that, and we are reaching a point in which we are going to have to increase either revenue sources through a voluntary increase in that half-cent sales tax. I'm in favor of a citizens-approved voter referendum to increase the sales tax, but we as the governments in this area have to do with our money what we said we were going to do, which was to build out mass transit.
Isn't that part of mass transit? Isn't the streetcar when it's up and not the little thing that runs four blocks now?
That's
with a little teeny car on it. It looks like San Francisco or something.
Right.
But when it's built out from Johnson C. Smith to Eastland Mall.
Yep.
With modern cars. Isn't that mass transit?
That is mass transit, but at what cost and where is the revenue source? I say it's fiscally irresponsible if, A, you're building a house where you can't pay for the mortgage, which is the operating costs, without increasing taxes. You're building a house piece by piece, assuming that you get state and federal funding. Furthermore, Mike, let me just point out to you, democratically controlled cities like San Antonio, Tampa, Arlington, Virginia, Washington, D.C. have had significant problems with this, and each of them have been dynamic and unique. But you look at San Antonio, where they're basically stopping it. They're trying to find ways to pay back the federal government. Same thing in Tampa. They're largely considering it, would be as a loss leader. It's now turning into a tourist-type scenario. Now, for example, I rode a streetcar in San Diego in April. Now, it has a completely different connectivity around that peninsula-type city, and it has a different funding source, and it has different business community support. And I'll come back to that as well, too. Where is the Charlotte Chamber like they were when we had the referendum on the sales tax in 2007? They were 100% full guns a-blazing saying, we want to see this light rail come up. Where is the Charlotte Chamber on this? They've largely sat on their hands because the business community knows this has got bad math associated with it. And again, I am for connecting our east and our west. I'm for connecting our east and our west, Mike. And that's where I challenge my friends to say, can the East and West Charlotte wait 2.5 decades in order for this to complete itself? 10 miles.
Okay, we have to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk about what do you do with it. You've got this streetcar that runs from the transportation center to the hospital, which is about, I don't know, 5 blocks, 6 blocks. What do you do with it? We have to take a break. We'll come back and get an answer to that in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Alpine Ski Center, Charlotte, outfitting skiers and snowboarders since 1976, hosting its season kickoff event this weekend with new performance winter clothing and snow sports gear, also in Greenville and Banner Elk. The House is poised to elect Paul Ryan as its new speaker. Republican presidential candidates take to the debate stage, with polls now showing Ben Carson in the top spot. So, this morning on the Diane Rehm Show, in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock, she and panelists will talk about the latest on the national GOP. And if you'd like to join our conversation with Charlotte mayoral candidate Edwin Peacock, now's your chance. Search for WFAE on Facebook or Twitter, or email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org. We're coming right back.
It's your world. We help you explore it.
You hear bombs and everything, and the people are very worried. You don't know when it will happen again. And the economy there have been really, really affected.
It's your community. We help you understand it.
Faculty leaders say for the better part of half a decade, the UNC Board of Governors has failed to follow its own stated principles of good governance.
Morning Edition on WFAE is an essential way to start your day and stay connected to your world. Listen weekday mornings from 5 to 9 on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Our guest, Edwin Peacock, the Republican candidate for Charlotte mayor in next Tuesday's election. His Democratic challenger, Jennifer Roberts, declined multiple overtures on our part to be here this morning.
Why did she do that, Mike?
I have no idea.
Why did she do that?
I don't book the show. I don't know.
Well, let me just remind you that in the John Lasseter and Anthony Fox race, John Lasseter one time did not appear at one of the debates against Anthony Fox, and he sent a mascot dressed as a chicken to his office. Now, they debated over 30 times. Patrick Cannon and I debated or appeared in other appearances 15, 16 times easily. I'm just surprised that my opponent won't come and be a part of the open dialogue that every one of the mayor's races have been drawn by. Again, I'm disappointed that Jennifer, whom I've known for quite some time, she certainly knows that she's not the enemy, she's the opponent. We're here to draw a contrast in our different leadership styles. But again, to have a one-sided testimonial here today without having Jennifer is just surprising to me. I mean, she's been in this game for a while.
But deep down inside, Edwin, in your heart of hearts, this is the best damn thing that could have ever happened to you.
Of course it is, Mike. We're really excited to be here. In fact, actually, we want to see this happen all the way till Election Day.
All right. Let's get back to the streetcar. But I don't want to spend a lot more time on the streetcar.
Oh, let's not.
What would you do with it? The fact it's here. We have this thing running on this track. What if you say it's a boondoggle and it's going to take 20 years to complete, and we don't know where the money is coming from, and we'll probably have to raise taxes to do it. Yeah. And you say that the business community has no confidence in the numbers being accurate. They don't work like the Lynx Blue Line evidently works, although there was a lot of disparagement about the Lynx Blue Line before it opened.
Still is.
Well, how can there be? That's ridiculous. but what do you do with it?
As I think, as I mentioned earlier,
tear up the tracks, take down.
No, I don't. I don't think that would be even more costly, and would obviously that corridor experienced a lot of disruption during as they were putting it together. I think, as I mentioned to you earlier, let's look at Tampa, let's look at San Antonio. I think they're largely chalking it up as a loss leader that they have to really pretty much eat that cost. Again, as mayor, I don't want to focus on this as something that's going to be a negative. We need to move forward.
You do believe in a 21st century transit plan, which I think that's a code word for no streetcar. But what would a 21st century transit plan include?
It has to be multimodal.
Meaning,
it has to be a transit plan that includes light rail, that includes bus rapid transit, that includes walkable, livable streets, bike lanes, all of the things that our transit plan of the 2020 and the 2030 plan espouse to. The next piece that it needs, Mike, is it needs flexibility to the rapid growth of technology and its interaction in the transportation field. Two examples, Mike. When I finished city council in 2011, the ink had not even dried on our decision to revise our ordinance for our passenger vehicle for hire, which was translation taxis at the airport. Mm-hmm. Fast forward about 13 months later, and all of a sudden you and I have something on our phone called Uber.
Right.
Again, a technological app that has revolutionized people's decisions on how they want to go anywhere in our city, and the shared economy begins. The second piece, January of this year, we become a Google Fiber city, one of eight cities in the United States. You can look no further at Google to peel behind the onion of what they're trying to do, along with every other technology company, which is to be the first to come up with a driverless car or a driverless bus. Edwin, you're talking about something that sounds like the Jetsons. What are you referring to?
But that, too, is 20 years away.
That was right. But again, when you hear our former mayor, the Secretary of Transportation, and you listen to the transportation experts say this is the single issue, it will occur. 5 or 10 years, I don't know. But a mayor has to look ahead, and I don't want technology landing in East and West Charlotte that's literally dead on arrival, hitched to a 19th century technology that we took off our streets in 1938 looking for and aspiring to this thing called the automobile that was coming on board. Again, that's where, again, we can't go backwards. We have to go forward, and we have to, again, have collective support.
So given what the Lynx Blue Line did for South End,
mm-hmm.
it birthed it. I mean, there was nothing there.
What did McCrory call it? Do you remember what he called it?
No.
He called it the corridor of CRAP.
Okay.
He took a lot of heat for that.
I believe he said the word.
Yes.
But anyway, as an economic development tool, even though the streetcar is on the street and the car is mixed in with automobile traffic, can it not be argued that it is an economic development tool for two sides of the city that have been woefully neglected?
Yes, it can. But again, you have to look at the economic development study that the streetcar task force put together that occurred just before the recession occurred. And the numbers looked very positive. But again, when you look at the marriage of the light rail and the Lynx Blue Line, it was the marriage between transit planning and land use. And that was a risk. We didn't know what was going to occur, and you see the success of what's occurred there. Will it occur at that type of scale going down Central Avenue, going down, Trade Street here, all the way to Beatty's Ford Road? I would hope that it would occur, and I don't want to abandon transportation.
Is it worth a try?
Well, is it worth a try at a cost of $500 million, $9,500 per square foot in consecutive property tax increases? Mike, one of the things I'm seeing, and I think that people agree, is that we are sitting in a situation now where we're really pitting a lot of people in certain parts of Charlotte that are bearing the brunt of the property tax increase, and they're asking, what type of return am I getting on that? That's where the argument for the light rail has actually become completely 180. We've had a lot of people that were the dissenters. These are people that live largely in South Charlotte that were opposed to the light rail now recognize that this has been working.
Couldn't that happen again?
It could, but again, yeah. At what cost? And again, okay. When you don't have the support of the region.
In your campaign literature, you say that if city council had to raise taxes to pay for $22 million budget shortfall, how bad will it get if council proceeds with a streetcar that could reach $500 million in costs mm-hmm. with no current revenue source? But before... We've already talked about the streetcar. So talk about this $22 million budget shortfall. Wasn't that caused by the Republican legislature taking away a revenue stream from this and other municipalities that it had grown to depend on, and they did it like that?
They did.
How do you prepare for something you don't even see coming?
Well,
that has been there for years.
Well, let's look at some of the budget math that occurred around what changed when Kurt Walton left, our previous city manager, to Manager Carley. Manager Walton said that if we want to fund a capital investment plan of $800+ million, which included a streetcar, that we needed to have about a 10% property tax increase. Manager Walton got through the Democratic convention. He said, I'm retiring. The city council hired a new city manager, and the new city manager said, I've found $63 million that we can move forward with the streetcar, the CIP, and we won't have to do a property tax increase. So if they found $63 million in property tax reserves, the question then becomes is that how do we solve the $22 million gap that was created by the business privilege tax of which this state decided to pull away from the major cities? I found it interesting that one of the individuals that was the most vocal about it was then State Senator Clodfelter, now our mayor. Now, the mayor, again, doesn't have a vote, but he does have a voice, and he is part of the solution as to how we're going to fill the gap. I just found it interesting that Mayor Clodfelter, while he was the biggest champion of that, he really wasn't leading the charge as far as trying to really fill the gap, either to stop the state from doing it or to find alternatives. Now, he did come up with some proposals with the budget committee. They were doing some basically what I call shuffling. They were moving things around and trying to find new ways to find fees and revenues. But again, you've got to have a council focused, Mike, around obviously addressing that shortfall. In this case, it wasn't something that happened overnight. We've known about that potential that they could pull that revenue away for probably about 5-6 years. So again, it's going to be based on a council that's going to have the resolve to look at their city manager and say, we don't want a property tax increase. That occurs when you have council members who say collectively, there's 6 votes that don't want this to happen.
Let me share some questions with you that are coming in from listeners as we speak. Michael on Twitter, toll lanes are a tax. What is Mr. Peacock going to do to stop the toll lanes? Is there anything the mayor of Charlotte can do to stop those toll lanes on I-77?
No, not specifically as the mayor. I've indicated that I want toll lanes to be the last option in our transit plan.
Aren't they at the South Carolina border?
That'd be a great question. I would like to see them at the South Carolina border. Many of South Carolina enjoys a lot of the assets that North Carolina has, particularly our airport. But again, when you look at toll lanes and what's happening, particularly with US 74 Independence Avenue and the expressway that's foreseen to obviously take people from uptown Charlotte all the way to Union County, again, you're seeing, I think, phase one in a debate with what's occurred on 77 is being case in point as to how you have to proceed very carefully with your transit options. We also need to recognize that, again, as the corridor up 77 arrived at the decision to go to the state for a public-private partnership or a P3, again, the details are where it really, really came clear to them that this may not be what they wanted, and it's just unfortunate what's occurred up that corridor. Again, Mike, when we talk about transit planning, many people say, why can't we have light rail up that corridor? Mm-hmm. Well, one answer is Norfolk Southern's not that interested in it, but also Huntersville, Cornelius, and Davidson, and even Mooresville have different feelings about it. But again, as a region, as a mayor, you're serving a large region. Our transit plan is built off regional planning where we're trying to get Charlotte out of the transit business.
Lucille wants to know, is it possible to be in favor of a proposal without being in favor of a tax increase to fund it?
I guess I would ask her, what is she referring to?
Perhaps the streetcar. I don't know, because that's what we were talking about probably when that question came in. Kathy writes, I am a fourth-generation Charlottean who grew up in the hood and who now lives in a middle-class neighborhood near South End. I had viewed Mr. Peacock as a person born with the proverbial silver spoon in his mouth who might not understand or connect with the issues of all citizens. However, after listening to this morning's show, I'm about to switch my vote to him, especially considering his views on the streetcar issue. Let me ask about something that does affect people in lower economic situations. You accurately point out that Charlotte ranks last in economic mobility of the 50 U.S. major U.S. cities. We're behind Detroit, which is a city that is struggling like no other. If you are born poor in Charlotte, the likelihood of you rising through the economic ranks is slim to none, evidently. Mm-hmm. You have a plan to fix that?
I have a plan to work with the task force that's been charged to tackle this issue. I was with D. O'Dell and Ophelia Garman-Brown last night. I think their work could be probably one of the most important task force we've seen in Charlotte in our last 20 years. And the reason why is because they're dealing with a very multifaceted and complex problem that won't be solved by one mayor, but it will be solved by the intentionality that we have as a community to address the three things that we know have got to help children who are at risk and in poverty. And I think first, it's obviously education. Secondly, it is mentorship. Third, I see it as skill building. Mike, one of the things that was very transformative just after I announced was just before that I saw Senator Tim Scott and I saw Secretary Fox at Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. I saw Senator Tim Scott answer the question, what is a black Republican, which was a very interesting answer. But what I heard was a man that grew up at risk, that grew up in projects, that said how I got out of this was education, how I got out of this was a mentor that showed me entrepreneurial skills and to build a company and help me to become self-employed. He also wants to do the exact same thing with at-risk youth. Another example, I was with Coach Derek Wittenberg recently, from NC State, who is a very effective leader, not only in the athletic world, but certainly to all NC State fans around as well, too. But I listen to his stories of youth engagement. I look at the stories, and I want to say, as a mayor, my job would be to help showcase the positives of what we can do to find those the most at risk and to bring them out of that. The mayor has to remove the barriers in order to do that. Now, certainly I don't have a direct impact over education, but what I do have an impact over is talking about setting a standard of excellence in this community and what we expect, and why I say that one of the most important things about why I'm running is that I want to set an example of leadership for the next generation, Mike, the next generation who I believe needs to see a mayor who is going to say, you need to do more in Charlotte as a citizen, but you need to do more for Charlotte. And I think that's also a role of an effective mayor.
We only have a couple minutes left, and you and your opponent have both talked a lot about education in this race, and the mayor
sure.
has no control. The county runs the schools. The state helps run the schools. They help fund the schools. You want to work with the next school board and with the state and local chambers of commerce and with families to find ways to improve schools. Do you have any concrete suggestions yet on how you might do that? And we came out pretty good recently in the math and reading scores that were in the paper this morning.
Yeah. Yep.
So,
very quickly, our strongest neighborhoods have one thing in common. They have strong schools. If we have strong schools that equal strong neighborhoods, we're going to have a strong city. So inherently, it is a city issue, but not formally. Three ideas that I would like to see happen as mayor. First is one that I know that I can control, and my city council, I hope, would support me. Charlotte has all of their meetings, the city council at 600 East 4th Street. I think we need to take the government on the road. I think we need to go to all seven of our city council districts, go to the at-risk schools that have now been ranked by our state as an F or a D. We need to host a city council meeting and a city forum there. The second thing that we need to do, I think we need to have a program tied to our housing initiatives that focuses on teachers and public safety workers to try to give them the ability to live in Charlotte and in or around some of the corridors that we've identified, East and West Charlotte being two of the identified corridors. And I think the third idea is one that comes off of my mentorship, if you will, from Mayor Venrude. He created a program called the International Awards Banquet, hosted by the mayor to recognize international companies. I want to see Charlotte have the first annual Mayor's Award for excellence in education, Mike. If mayors are out doing ribbon cutting and rewarding people, I would much rather reward excellence in education K-12 through our great universities here, our Central Piedmont Community College. But why not showcase teachers, students, and achievement, and talk about excellence in our schools from the mayor's position, not as a policymaker?
You have talked enough, you've filibustered enough so that I cannot ask you about your being a skateboarder with a half pipe in your backyard. Rats. Edwin Peacock, Republican candidate for mayor of Charlotte. Thank you for the hour. We invited Jennifer Roberts. She declined.